Thank you for staying tuned. Thank God it's Friday. The last working day in the month of April 2022. Tomorrow is April 30, and then May 1st is a Sunday. My name is Anobere. How are you? So 2 days ago, there was a mass burial for over 110 victims of Imo explosion. What happened was that an illegal refinery at the Abeze Forest in Ohaji, Ibema, local government area of Imo State. There was an explosion, and of course, people were there. Some people there are said to be refiners. Others were those who went there to buy products. And I'm sure there are other people that were caught in between, you know, 110. That was the figure that the official figures from NEMA. In that kind of incident, it's almost difficult to get any other figures because of the magnitude of the incident. You know, the videos that were shared online, the photos, bodies burned beyond recognition, cars burnt as well. It was massive. So what did they do? They evacuated the bodies, and there was a mass burial. Of course, the Imo State government declared the person who owned that illegal refinery wanted, and then you start to ask a question. So they knew the person, or is it that they did not know? Is it possible that such large-scale refinery could be operating and nobody saw the smoke, nobody saw the movement in and out of petroleum products? Well, it has cost lives and, of course, property. And then, would it happen again? Some people would say, God forbid, but it's very likely. Maybe not at that scale, but it would happen again because we still have other illegal refineries operating in the Niger Delta region. This morning on the show, we're talking combating upstream oil theft and pipeline vandalism in Nigeria. My guest, Professor Ben Nanen, had a presentation earlier in the week, and he's here now. Good morning, Prof.
Good morning.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
So in the course of your presentation and putting up that presentation, you did some research. You visited some areas. Tell us some of the things that you found.
Well, it's a study that I've been undertaking in the past almost 2 years now, together with Nigerian and international partners. And the basic aim was to focus on ways in which Nigeria could address the issue of oil theft and pipeline vandalism. And we focus really actually on combating it, because there have been numerous efforts. There have been all kinds of initiatives by the government and the oil companies, but the issue is not abating. Rather, we have evidence that it's even increasing. You could see what happened in River State in January, where the governor had to take the issue of soot all over the state, especially around the Port Harcourt region. And the lines of trucks on East West Road, going where only God knows every day, filled with illegal crude or illegally refined oil. It was an open secret. So there is every tendency, every indication that the issue was increasing instead of abating, in spite of all the efforts by the government and the oil companies. In fact, as of last count, the minister of MD of NNPC indicated that we were losing 200,000 barrels of oil per day. And translated into monetary terms, in terms of the current prices, that amounted to $7.2 billion that Nigeria is losing
every day.
Every year.
Yeah,
okay. $7.2 billion, which could fund so many departmental budgets, as it were, health, education, especially the social budgets. You could imagine the degree of loss, and that is all that we know. There are others that we cannot account for. So that was part of the reason that I had to investigate the issue, both here in Nigeria and outside, because Nigeria isn't the only country affected by oil theft. But the scale, industrial scale theft in Nigeria puts the country in a class of its own.
Why do you call it industrial scale?
I mean, it is nothing that is so small. It is on a very massive scale. That is why we call it industrial scale.
So where does the oil go to, the one that is stolen?
That is the issue. We try to investigate. About 30% of that goes into local artisanal processing, the so-called illegal refineries, and the 30% goes abroad.
70.
70, rather, thank you very much. 70% goes abroad to foreign refineries.
How does it go abroad? How do they transport it?
Well, that is the issue that the security agencies in the country should answer, because these are carried in ships. Okay, it's not something that is hidden. They are not taking through bush paths or motorbikes or anything. These are shiploads that are carried from Nigeria's territorial waters. We try to find out how that could be, but I mean, the answer to some of these questions aren't very, very easy. All right, the Navy says there are so many ships in the territorial waters, and so it's difficult to begin to investigate every ship that is carrying what. And I find that a bit disconcerting, because there should be agencies, and there are agencies that are responsible for every ship that enters the Nigerian territorial waters. They should be able to know which ship brings in what and which ship takes out what. The Navy is there, and the NIMASA, and other, these are the two principal agencies, but there are also other agencies that are connected. And the fact that they don't know exactly the destination of this stolen oil is something that is difficult to explain. But the truth, the long and short of it, is that they leave Nigeria's territorial waters destined for foreign refineries.
And someone gets paid.
People are benefiting from that. Both in terms of loading the oil, getting everything, the whole industry. It's a huge gravy train, especially among the elite in the country, the security agencies, IOCs, and so on, you see, and the political leaders.
Let's look at the role the locals play in all of this, because all of the refining going on, the one called artisanal, illegal, they're going on in communities. Let's talk about the role the locals play.
Well, the locals, actually, initially we thought it was a problem of poverty. Okay. It still is. But we have to remember that those who carry the most oil, those who steal the most oil in the export sector, they are not poor people at all. These are people driven by capital accumulation. These are people living in mansions in Port Harcourt, Abuja, Lagos, and elsewhere in Nigeria. Because it has become a national issue. It's no longer just a Niger Delta issue. But initially, the local artisanal refinery was done by unemployed and poverty-stricken youth. But it's no longer the case, because people are investing in it. People bring in money. It's not getting to the issue of capital investment. So it's no longer as it was in the initial days, where you could just get some drums and some pipes and start connecting and doing what they know best. It's no longer exactly the case today. People from all over Nigeria are coming to the Niger Delta. They are investing, putting capital into that whole thing. And so it's a huge problem. It's a huge problem. But again, it's the inadequacy of the system that has largely made that market to thrive. Shortage of refined products, and of course, shortages always drive up prices. And we see what is happening. You know, diesel, which is the largest product of the artisanal refineries, is so expensive. Because since Nigeria is not putting its refineries in order, it has to be imported. And diesel is deregulated. It doesn't enjoy subsidy like petrol. And so it's very expensive. And so you now see a very lucrative market in which investors are very willing to invest.
Yeah, but you know, some people on the other side would want to say, we would like, or we believe that modular refineries is the answer.
I don't think so. Yes, because they call it modular refinery, there is a misconception that modular refineries are cheap. They aren't cheap.
No, but you talked about capital investment.
Capital investment in the illegal artisanal refineries, not the modular refineries. These are two different things. Yeah. All right. The modular refineries are engineering constructions, legitimate. All right. It's only the scale that makes it different from the regular official refineries. Okay. All right. But that is different from the artisanal refineries. And the modular refineries, people keep saying that that is the answer. That is the answer. To me, that isn't the answer. All right? Because it is very capital intensive. It's not the sort of thing that the locals can afford. You know, the one in Imo State, the one that was opened late last year, okay, it was about $30 million. All right? The Nigerian Content, Local Content Monitoring Agency, Development Board, invested $10 million. And according to them, that was about 30% of the cost of that refinery. And as we speak, it barely produces 10,000 barrels of diesel per day at that cost. So still, it's not very, it's really capital intensive.
So if we're going to go by that, the cost, then who would take up that business? Who will take up, you know, building modular refineries?
It means that, the ideology of development now is private sector driven. It means that the private sector has to be able to do that.
So if they're doing it and the artisanal refiners still steal the crude, how will they be able to do the business?
That is the issue, all right? If the modular refineries are getting crude legitimately.
Buying crude
legitimately. And the artisanal refineries are stealing crude. I mean, it's going to undermine that whole process of modular refineries. But let me say this. The artisanal refineries, they don't really steal it.
Oh, tell me.
They buy it from the point owners.
Those that steal it?
Yes. Okay. They buy it from those that steal it. The point owner, those who people own the tapping points. And from there, they sell to the local artisanal refiners and also the export buyers. So that is what is happening. So the people who are actually benefiting most from the gravy train are the tapping point owners and those who provide protection services, such as the security agencies. So we have to disabuse our mind about free crude for artisanal refiners. But actually, they are not buying at the market price. Like every stolen product, it is subsidized. You see, that is the difference. Okay, but if you have to bridge that niche between artisanal refining and modular refining, there has to be a way of ensuring that maybe the oil companies, of course, all the major oil companies are in partnership with the government through NNPC, that they have to find a way of bridging that so that they can collect money. The money that is given to the point owners can actually go to the oil companies and the government of Nigeria, and they mitigate the huge financial losses that this company, the huge hemorrhage that we have in the oil sector. So that is quite possible. It takes the political will for the government to be able to do some of these things. In fact, even combating the issue of oil theft and pipeline vandalism. Other countries, they've been facing it.
We'll talk about other countries in a bit, but you talked about triggers during your presentation. Can you tell us some of the triggers?
The traders are local traders in the... Oh, the triggers, actually, you know, from about 2000, there have been spike in oil prices, although the trend is cyclical. But throughout the 90s, for example, and late 80s, the prices of oil remained low. And then from about 2000, it started rising, reaching its peak of about, they were talking about $60 per barrel in 2005. And so you now see that it became very lucrative to steal and sell oil. The world has been in need of cheap oil. And so when you have the subsidized stolen oil from Nigeria, there is a ready market. And that is one of the important triggers. And then on the domestic front, you have the discovery or rediscovery of the technique of refining, local refining. For example, in the Niger Delta, it's been a long-term tradition historical tradition in the Niger Delta about the refining of local gin that the colonial authorities call illicit gin. And people were prosecuted for that. So it was just a way of reinventing a technique that was already there. And besides that, the pipelines were held in awe because people thought they were very dangerous to be tampered with because they are under intense pressure, the pipelines, once oil is flowing in them. And so people were scared. But the whole idea of tapping, the people now discovered that this thing could be, the pipelines could be tapped. You know, what we call hot and cold tapping. And so that mystification disappeared. And people were not tapping directly. So the technique of tapping also stimulated the issue of oil theft. So these are some of the triggers. But the other fundamental factors, the background issues, are basically economic poverty, all right? On the part of the local youth, poverty and unemployment. On the part of the elite, the desire for capital accumulation to acquire wealth. They cannot be said to be driven by poverty at all. Okay, those who are in their mansions elsewhere in Nigeria and giving orders on telephone, they are not poor people in any sense of it. And so these are some of the issues we looked at. Okay.
All right. We're talking to Professor Ben Nanin, give a presentation on combating oil theft and pipeline vandalism in Nigeria earlier this week in Port Harcourt, and he shared some of what he's found with us. Something very critical he said, this isn't peculiar to Nigeria. Other countries have experienced and dealt with cases of oil theft before. How did they do that? Did they succeed? What is likely to happen if Nigeria wants to activate political, we're talking about the political office holders. He mentioned that elites are part of this. They're the ones living in posh buildings and making calls, and the foot soldiers are working. I'm sure that majority of those who died, if not all of them, were part of what we would call the foot soldiers. But the big boys who are chilling somewhere were giving orders, and they are still there and they're protected. How does a ship, how do ships sail on the waters into another territory and nobody knows? We're Nigerian Info. We keep talking after the commercial. My name is Enoch Bavire. Stay tuned.
We take off with the biggest conversations with an exchange of opinions and ideas on the Morning Crossfire. Settle you into your day when we say hello, Port Harcourt.
Take you on a ride to the sunny side of life.
Hover a bit while picking at the details on hard facts.
Take a detour through the exciting world of sports.
And get back on track with Let's Talk.
Land you safely as we chit-chat into the morning on Chat Station. And then do it all over again on your number one talk, news and sports radio station, 92.3 Nigeria Info.
Thank you for staying tuned. We've got 27 minutes before we hit the 9 o'clock mark. My name is Enoch Bevere. We're talking combating upstream oil theft and pipeline vandalism in Nigeria. My guest is Professor Ben Nanin. Good morning, Prof. Again.
Thank you,
All right, so you said several countries have fought oil theft and, you know, some recorded success, but there are five countries most plagued by oil theft. This is a 2014 document. Nigeria says as much as 400,000 barrels of oil stolen per day. That's about...
400,000,
please? No, this is 2014.
Oh, okay, okay. All
right. So it's reduced.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yes, 400,000 a day, followed by Mexico. Mm-hmm. They had just about 10,000 barrels per day. That was as of 2015. Then Iraq... Mm-hmm. Also, Russia and Indonesia. Okay, so some countries have fought this before. Mm. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, actually, we examined about five countries. Of course, our target, our focus is Nigeria, but we also look at Mexico, which is a distant second. Then Russia, Colombia, Brazil, and Singapore. Okay. The case of Singapore is interesting because it's not really tapping from pipelines and so on. Singapore is the world's leading center of bunkering. That is transshipment, where ships go and fill their, you know, it's like filling station for land transportation. Okay, so that one is mostly in a different class of its own, but not still on the same scale. Yeah, as you have in the case of Nigeria, which is, as I said earlier, is in a class of its own. So in Mexico, it's been a big problem. And in 1998 and 20 some years ago, it is 2022, 2018, right, a new president came to power, AMLO Obrador, Mr. Obrador, who came to power, campaigned explicitly on the platform of combating organized crimes and oil theft. And as soon as he came to power at the end of the year, he put in motion very stringent regime to be able to deal with that problem. And he shut down some of the theft-prone pipelines, shut them completely. Okay, the people suffered for it, but at the end of the day, they benefited. They were constant because they were tired of the problem, all right? There were shortages here and there and so on, and clamped down on businesses that traded in illegal oil, withdrawing license, canceling licenses, jailing people in the oil sectors that were complicit, because theft, oil theft is not really possible without insiders in the industry, all right? And so, like in the case of Mexico, you have one large oil companies in the upstream and downstream sector, which is Pemex, okay, that controls the whole oil industry. A lot of workers were sacked, dismissed summarily. And so quite a number of stringent measures. Filling stations or service stations that sold illegal oil were shut down. And in less than 6 months, oil theft decreased by more than 93%. As of the last data I saw, covering 2020, the figure was still that way. All right, which means that it worked. And that is a question of political will. This man campaigned on that platform, organized crime. So he tried to dismantle them, although it's not really entirely possible to eradicate. But at least there have been some serious mitigation factors.
90-something percent.
Yes,
that's
93%.
That's a resounding success.
Yes. So the issue is to be able to sustain it. But at least for in the interim, we knew that it was a success. So that was our finding in the case of Mexico. The other country, the problem is not so serious. And so they adopt different approaches, the judicial approach, criminalization, jailing people that are convicted and so on. Even Brazil took the intelligence approach to mount an intelligence system to preempt, because according to them, they don't want to be like in Mexico. All right? So different countries, different approaches, but nothing comparable to what is happening in Nigeria, where the elite are so complicit. It's so obvious, all right? People talk about the military getting involved. Even the state governor has mentioned it several times and so on. Okay, we all knew what happened here in January. That became so open. But these are things that became secret, that have been secret, but open secret as it were, that the people who should be protecting the pipelines and our economy are the people sabotaging it. The elite, political leaders, and so on, people you least expect. You see, we are living in a country where morality doesn't count. Provided you make the money, people worship you. Otherwise, to be in a position of authority, to be in a position of power, and get involved in that country, to be representing the people, it should have been regarded as highly criminal activity, to be highly punishable. But you don't have that kind of thing in Nigeria. And so, as I say, it's a gravy tray. Everybody is on it.
So, but we're here now. Where would this take us if it doesn't stop, or if it's not mitigated?
Okay. That is the issue. The country is clearly fighting a losing war.
Already.
The way things are at the moment. So it calls for clearer thinking. It calls for new thinking. It calls for new innovative approach. It calls for a paradigm shift. Okay, so that is what we should be looking at. If you cannot stop it, what do you do? Maybe you do something about it. Okay, look at certain sector, like the refining sector, and try to see what we can do to make the best out of it. Okay, what we call formalization. All right, to see if you formalize it so that you can make the best of it. It will help in mitigating petroleum shortages in the country. It will also build capacity in the petroleum sector. There are quite a number of advantages that we can derive, including revenues.
Formalization, yes, would it entail what exactly?
Formalization is to say, okay, this issue, let's make the best of it. Let's not entirely criminalize it. Okay. Let's look at certain aspects of it that we can get benefit, that we add value to the economy and society, and see how we can arrange it so that it doesn't become entirely illegal anymore. All right? Because if you formalize it, you cannot regulate it. Okay? You cannot regulate what you don't approve of. That is a thing. And so I think that is part of the issue we should be looking at. Let's look at, people have asked about the modality, how do you do that? But the first thing to do is to be committed in principle that we have to look at it alternatively, maybe formalize it. Once that principle is established, then we can now begin to look at the modalities for doing it. To me, it is doable. As I have said earlier, take for example, the issue of buying the crude. Instead of buying the crude from the illegal tap owners who are, you know, laughing to the bank every day, that thing should be between the government and the oil companies. Okay, that money could go in there. All right? You could also reduce some of the dangers through regulation if you formalize it. You could, there are quite a number of things that we can do. The important is to agree that we can do so, and we should do it. That is the point. You know, this whole question of artisanal refining, it also affected the solid mineral sector all over the world. Okay? But what has been done over the years is that the whole issue of formalization has been discussed. And the World Bank is even funding all this small-scale artisanal refining mining business. That haven't been done. The oil sector, artisanal refining sector in Nigeria could also is formalized, benefit from such international support, as it were. So I do believe that confronted with a losing battle, okay, we should do something different from what we are doing at the moment.
All right, Professor Nanin here. You have questions, you need some clarity, 0817-923-0003, 0817-923-0009 are the numbers to call. Thango says, okay, let me just read the part that, you know, talks to us here. It says, federal government should do the needful and save Nigerians from dying of vandalism. Some of the oil workers are beneficial of this oil theft, making it lucrative. Stanley, many people in government enjoy the benefits from oil theft. Oil theft is lucrative. It's been perpetrated by people in the oil industry, well known by the authorities around the areas. Okay, we've got Nibari Klein. Says, I want to believe that our government enjoys the benefits gotten from oil theft. Chile Edwin, oil theft is lucrative. It's been perpetrated by the people in the oil industry, well known by the authorities. JJ is calling from Umokoro. Good morning.
Good morning to the great prof in the studio. Prof, I'm aware that we don't even have meter that we use to measure the amount of export that we do from the export terminal. I remember during Yaradua, I signed a contract for the installation of meters even when Jonathan came in, increased the contract sum, and not today, we have not done that contract. We've not successfully launched that meter. Now, how do we now know what is going out and what is coming in? This is on the backdrop of what the president came back with some time ago when he went on Earth vacation. And some people gave him some document where I would say that oil grew in transit, where they record that they had 3 million barrels when they were living here and they discharged 5 million barrels. So without a meter and measuring measures, how do we even start to cut this oil test? Thank you very much, Prof.
Thank you for that question. On the lack of reliable metering system is part of the irregularities of the oil industry, especially the export sector in Nigeria. That is well known. Sometimes this could be intentional, but sometimes it is a systemic problem that we've not been able to fix. But once the government decides and the oil company decides to install the proper, adequately calibrated meters, that can adequately measure the amount of oil being exported, I think we can do it. It's doable. Often, the problem that we have most of the time is the will to be able to do some of the proposals that we make. It's not like reinventing the wheel to have the type of meters that can adequately measure the amount of oil we are exporting. But again, you mentioned the question, what we call topping, in that you didn't use that word, but it's very rampant at the oil terminal. The oil companies and those and others involved in regulating that technical aspect, they deny it, but there is evidence that there is a large-scale oil theft out the terminals. Okay, the issue of topping, perhaps the manifest carries a certain amount of oil, but actually what is topped is another percentage of it, okay, that is not accounted for. So that practice evidently is there.
All right, let's talk to Ezekiel from Ada George. Ezekiel, good morning. You're on.
I have a question, maybe two.
Okay.
Now, your guest in the studio talked about different approaches from by different countries trying to cut oil theft. And at the same time, he also mentioned the fact that in Nigeria here, as it were, we know the causes and the people responsible for the oil theft in Nigeria. Now, two questions I want to ask quickly. You just talked about artisanal refinery that should be regulated since you are fighting a loose battle already. This thing that these guys are doing in the creek, destroying our mangrove, destroying aquatic life, and are also endangering human life. Is it what is referred to as artisanal refinery? I want to know. This cooking, is it what is referred to as artisanal refinery that we should regulate and continue? That's number one. Then number two, if you already know the cause of a thing, what makes it so difficult to solve that problem? You already know the cause. You already know the people involved. You already know the persons that are committing the crime. Why is it utmost difficult to solve such a problem in Nigeria? Thank you.
Thank you, Ezekiel. Hold on. Let's take Paul's comment. Paul, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. My question, number one, this type of oil theft in Nigeria, is it obtainable in other countries? Number two, are there other countries in the world that produces oil and then import the product from abroad? And number three is that, though similar to the first one, is there all these artisanal refineries that we are talking about, are they obtainable other places? Thank you.
All right, thank you, Paul, for calling. Prof?
Okay. Thank you. Maybe I take from the last for the first. Actually, as I said, there are other countries that are involved, but not on the scale as it is in Nigeria. The level in Nigeria is quite scandalous and very shameful, as it is. A country that loses 10 to 14% of its annual oil production, on which the economy depends. We have to be seriously concerned about that. Actually, Nigeria is facing a clear and present danger. A country that is so poor, we can't fund public infrastructure, education, health, and so on, losing $7.2 billion per year to oil theft is something that should actually be a national concern, actually a state of emergency, if possible. But like most other things in this country, we talk about these things and move on, and the problem continues to stare us in the face. All right. So, in the case of Russia also, a lot of the stolen oil goes into smaller refineries. The Russians call them samovars. Samovars. Okay. So it's not only in Nigeria. In other countries, in Mexico, both the crude and refined are stolen. But most of the stolen oil is refined product. But it becomes a problem because we are dealing with the issue of pipeline security and integrity. Okay. All right? So it's the same thing. So there are countries that are involved, but not definitely anything close to what is happening in Nigeria at all. We cannot find such evidence of such a scale of theft in any other country. Mexico is a very distant second. It occurs in Russia, and most of these things occur in the developing economies. Okay. Most Western economies, all is stolen quite all right, but in the United States, it's mostly in the process of transporting oil by truck. So the drivers will pilfer. Mm. So when the Americans talk about oil theft, that is the kind of thing they are talking about. They are not talking about people installing taps on pipelines and stealing massive amounts of oil. It happens also even in Japan, in other countries. Oil is one of the world's hottest commodities. And so you really see that you cannot be safe anywhere. But in all these countries, people, governments have adopted measures to, you know, to tackle the problem. And in most cases, prevent them from happening. Right? So
someone asked about what artisanal refining is. Have you answered that one?
Yeah, the artisanal, somebody talked about the environmental impact of artisanal refining. Actually, if you regulate it, for example, you'll be able, if you formalize it, so to say, you'll be able to regulate it. You'll be able to establish standard. So if you don't operate according to that standard, your license will be withdrawn. And so that is the issue. But you cannot regulate something, a process that you criminalize. Right? So that is the issue. Okay.
Promise is calling, a final call. Good morning, Promise.
Yeah, good morning, Eno.
You're on.
Okay, I just have one question this morning concerning what we are saying this morning, our discussion. If a particular fight or struggle, is it a personal struggle, a personal fight?
What
like
do you mean?
Our guest mentioned the last time here, we discovered that during January period, the governor of Rivers State, how he fought this issue of illegal refining of the thing.
When you say personal, what does that mean?
You say?
When you say personal, what does that mean?
As in, what I mean is the federal government is not doing anything concerning this issue.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. I think the government is doing something.
Okay. Let's just stop it there.
Okay.
Let's just stop it there.
Yeah.
The government is doing something.
Okay.
But I mean, from the onset, Prof here said that it looks like it's a lost battle because of, you know, the lack of political will, and if there's no political will, then we can't even talk sustainability.
Yeah.
But we have to anchor here this Friday morning. Thank you very much, Professor Ben Annan, for your time.
Yeah.
And we hope that at some other time you'll be able to honor our invitation to Nigerian Info.
Oh, thank you, Eno, and our listeners. Thank you very much, and have a pleasant day. Good.
All right. Okay, it's live on Facebook at NigeriaInfo.ph. Of course, you can listen to the podcast much later. And don't forget to visit our website, NigeriaInfo.fm. My name is Enoh Gbeviri. Good morning.